From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
My friends, we beat fear with hope. We beat cynicism with hard work. We beat negative, divisive politics with a positive vision that brings Canadians together.
That was the leader of the Liberal Party of Canada, Justin Trudeau, as he addressed supporters at Montreal's Queen Elizabeth Hotel in the wee hours Tuesday after he was elected to be Canada's new Prime Minister.
You want a Prime Minister who knows that if Canadians are to trust their government needs to trust Canadians. Thank you very much. Merci. Merci.
Trudeau and his Liberal Party trounced the Conservatives and their Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, in a sweep that saw the Liberal Party capture 184 of the 338 seats in the House of Commons. The Conservatives were reduced to 99 seats from 159 in the last parliament, according to preliminary results, while the New Democratic Party, which had held second place and formed the official opposition in the last parliament, held on to only 44 seats after suffering substantial losses in Quebec to the Liberals. The unexpected rout occurred 47 years after Trudeau's father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, had first swept to power. He served as the 15th Prime Minister of Canada from April 20, 1968 to June 4, 1979, and again from March 3, 1980 to June 30, 1984. The legacy of the elder Trudeau includes the implementation of official bilingualism, the so-called patriation of the Constitution, which in essence formalized Canada's sovereignty from Britain, and the establishment of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Canada's constitutional Bill of Rights.
We've been very clear that Assad wouldn't necessarily have to leave tomorrow or the next day. He can't be, you know, for obvious reasons, he cannot be a part of the solution here in terms of that transitional government that does emerge.
That was U.S. State Department spokesperson Mark Toner at his daily press conference Monday, apparently marking a change in U.S. policy towards Syria mere weeks into the Russian bombing campaign in that country against ISIS and other terrorists. For the past 4.5 years, it's been U.S. policy that the departure of President Bashar al-Assad was a precondition to any further movement towards peace. That position has apparently changed. Now, it seems the U.S. administration is insisting that Assad cannot be part of a transitional government. However, that apparent change in U.S. policy may simply be a case of kicking the can down the road, as Toner's later remarks indicated.
Yes, sir.
If it is your belief, as you've just said, that the Russian military operations in Syria are designed to prop up, to strengthen Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and if, as you said, it is the U.S. belief that Assad cannot play any role in an eventual sort of future Syria after some indeterminate transitional period, what makes you think that those two impulses, the Russian to prop up Assad and the U.S. desire to see Assad go, are not irreconcilable objectives?
Well, as the Secretary said in New York, there are areas on which we agree with the Russia. We agree that, you know, ISIL is a profound enemy. It needs to be destroyed. We agree that Syria needs to remain whole and intact and secular. We agree there needs to be a political resolution, or at least that's what they say. And yet, you're right, we come up against this obstacle, whatever, however you want to describe it, of Assad's future. You know, our ultimate belief, I guess, is that, you know, Russia will realize it's playing a losing hand, however you want to frame that or describe that, in propping up a political leader who represents a minority and who has carried out, as I said, an unspeakable campaign of terror against his own people.
The war of words between Washington and Beijing continues over U.S. opposition to China's island-building activities in the South China Sea. In the latest round, China's Deputy Foreign Minister Liu Jianmin spoke with CCTV's Tian Wei about recent comments by the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter.
Recently, the Defense Secretary of the United States, Mr. Carter, was talking about the U.S. would sail, fly, and operate in wherever when the international law would permit.
That's kind of not a very positive remark. It's a kind of a rather provocative remarks. Because actually, we respect the freedom of navigation and the freedom of flight by any country in accordance with the South China Sea, but they should exercise freedom in accordance with the international law. With international law means that the freedom of navigation, freedom of flight has its limits. They have to respect the international law itself. Secondly, they also have to respect the rights and the interests of the littoral states, coastal states. So this is a kind of the balance has been regulated by international law.
They were saying as long as there are military equipment that is possibly used to launch a military attack, that would mean already militarized islands. Well, if that is the concept, it seems that what China and some of the other countries have been doing is really bringing things to the edge of a conflict.
Actually, you see, on those illegally occupied islands and reefs by our neighboring countries in the South China Sea, especially among the Nansha Islands, they are already militarization. And all these countries, they have installed military facilities and weapons. This is one thing. Secondly, you will see that every day there are foreign warships. They are patrolling and they are passing by through South China Sea. So South China Sea has been already, if you're talking about militarization, it's not started by China, but by others. We're trying to advise and persuade the others to believe us that we don't want to militarize the island reefs which we constructed and we reclaimed. And we want to have more, civilian facilities. Of course, necessary defense facilities are needed. Because we are surrounded. These islands and reefs are surrounded. Our people on these islands are surrounded by militarized islands and by the military equipment, by the warships passing by in these waters. So they need to necessary military facilities for self-defense.
When it comes to, for example, China's relations with Vietnam and China's territorial disputes with the Philippines, they seem to be extremely difficult.
No, it's actually, of course, you see, the settlement of these territorial disputes, normally we want to achieve a win-win result. But at the same time, we don't want to sacrifice our fundamental interests. That's why I see some of disputes and differences still can be left over. At the same time, that's why we don't want the disputes becoming kind of obstacle for the development of the bilateral relations. That's why I see Chinese government has initiated some principles like joint development, joint cooperation. That's why, especially for maritime disputes, of course, we are advocating and we are pushing forward the settlement of maritime disputes through negotiations. But you see, negotiations are not so easy. Until now, we have only this delimited part of the sea boundaries with Vietnam in the Bay. But on the maritime dispute with all other rest of the countries, I think negotiation will continue, but it will take a long time.
Cynthia McKinney, the former six-term member of Congress from Georgia and 2008 Green Party presidential candidate, recently earned a Ph.D. in Leadership and Change from Antioch University. For her dissertation, Dr. McKinney explored the challenges faced by the late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. She's now exploring ways to deploy more of what she calls non-traditional black candidates for Congress. But she says that's easier said than done, as she explained to Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
The electoral structure in the U.S. is very difficult because we don't have one national system. We have 50 separate systems governed by the rules of all of the different states. But where it is possible, the whole idea of a non-traditional candidate is not necessarily a non-democratic party candidate, because in some places it just doesn't make election sense because the election laws are so regressive. What I meant by that was Chokwe Lumumba type candidates, people who may previously have rejected being involved in the political process in electoral politics, but now who understand that the goal is a change of public policy. And the only way you're going to get the changed public policy is to have candidates who are committed to changing the current policies. And that's not going to come from people whose minds are closed or people who are wedded to the leadership that is responsible for the dire conditions that exist in our community now. And quite frankly, that's Democratic Party non-action.
So it sounds like you're talking about a resurgence of independent black politics. What is the state of independent black politics in the U.S. today?
It's been so set back. In 2005, 2006, 2005, of course, was the year of Hurricane Katrina. 2006, I believe that there actually was such a high disgust with the abject failure of the Democratic Party to do anything of substance with the masses of black votes that it accumulated, and with those black votes empowered people to make public policy decisions on behalf of the black community, and then they failed. They totally failed. So 2006, I believe, was the time for something of substance to happen. If you remember what was going on at the time, there was the effort to impeach George W. Bush, and the Democrats had said, you put us in the majority in the Congress and we'll do impeachment and we'll roll back the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. And none of that was done. The people went to the polls and they dutifully voted Democratic. And then the war funding continued. The impeachment was put off the table. And, you know, Hurricane Katrina survivors are still trying to find their way back home. And so nothing was done. The Democratic Party's response to what I believe and perceive to be very real black anger, black voter anger, was the nomination of Barack Obama. And so people who should have known better, and I believe in many cases did know better, fell in line and said, oh, we can't press a demand because we've got to get this individual man elected to office. And so whatever public policy initiatives that could have been obtained or commitments that could have been obtained at the time, the Democratic Party got black vote for free. And we see what has happened to us because we gave our vote to the Democratic Party for free.
Well, of course, 2008 was a singular moment in history in that there was a black candidate for president of the United States. You, of course, have also been a black candidate for president of the United States, but one with the backing of one of the two big business parties. So would 2016 be an opening for that kind of independent black politics that you believe should have kicked into high gear after Katrina?
Well, it could, but unfortunately, the ingredients are there. In fact, it's almost like the cook in the kitchen, because the kitchen is fully stocked. It has everything that's needed in order to make a beautiful red velvet cake. It's got everything in the kitchen to make this beautiful cake. But first of all, you need a cook who knows the recipe, and you need a fully functioning oven, and you need some other things, you know? You need this kind of wisdom. And somehow, we've just regressed politically. Look at how far away we've come from Frederick Douglass, who said that power concedes nothing without a demand. There was a lot of emotionalism after Hurricane Katrina, and I tried to put forward some demands. Those demands were summarily rejected. I was laughed at. But demands like providing homes for homeless people, utilizing the Housing and Urban Development Department's housing stock. And now, look, we see the state of Utah doing that. We see the city of New Orleans doing just that. They're only focusing on the veterans, but the housing stock that exists inside the United States is enough to solve the homeless problem. We don't have to have homeless people. I also offered legislation after Hurricane Katrina to deny funding and federal equipment to any police department that was found to have violated the civil rights of the people that it's charged to serve. And of course, that was laughed at. And now look at what we're facing. So the answer to our problems, whether it's the economy, it's imprisonment, it's social justice of any sort, the answer is still a change in public policy. And that is only going to happen. I don't know how many times you got to get hit in the face before you understand that you're not going to get it from the current crop of players. The current crop of players are looking out for themselves, looking out for special interests, and the black community is not counted as a special interest the day after the election takes place.
From reading your letter, you seem to be saying that just as grassroots organizations should be putting forward a list of demands, so at the same time should people, as you describe them, inside the political process, that is, in the electoral political process, also be putting forward similar lists of demands. And that would scare the daylights out of the power structure, you say.
And actually, it's not even a similar list. It should be the same list, because inside or outside the system, the bottom line is that we're all outside. Whether you have the opportunity to cast a vote in the Congress or you don't, inside, you're still an outsider. But, you know, we have a mindset of individuals who believe that because they now get a chance to vote, that they're insiders. The one thing that my father always told me is that it doesn't matter if you get to vote or you don't get a vote, you're still an outsider. And our strength comes from the outside. The strength that we have on the inside only comes because of the strength of the outside. And if for any reason we fail to understand the connection between the inside and the outside, that means that those people on the inside are Rambos. They are just independent actors that have been completely divorced from the community. Now, they can come back to the community and they can talk a good game, But when they are there, they, as one member of Congress told me when I asked that all of the Congressional Black Caucus members to come to the Hurricane Katrina panel with me, just told me, well, Cynthia, you just got to understand that when the Democratic Party's leadership tells us not to do something, we're not going to do it. That is the mindset that has to be eliminated. Otherwise, the people who are charged with representing us don't represent us. They represent the leadership of the Democratic Party. And the leadership of the Democratic Party has fully well demonstrated that it doesn't care very much about public policy to address the concerns of the Black community, although they care very much about making sure that on Election Day, Black voters who unquestionably go to the polls and vote Democratic have the opportunity to do that, but don't ask for anything the day after or the day before the election.
Everybody listening to this interview is wondering whether you might be part of this coalition of independent Black congressional candidates or just act in an advisory kind of capacity.
Well, I took some time out and I worked on my PhD. I've completed that now. You can call me doctor. And it would be nice to have a doctor in the house who was not beholden to the Dr. Condoleezza Rice's and the Dr. Susan Rice's. But that's a question that I don't have an answer for yet. And the answer isn't really going to come from me. It's a question that all of us, I guess, have to pose to these voters. Is there a constituency for Cynthia McKinney in the political process in the United States? That's a question that needs to be asked and answered by the people who do the voting and the supporting.
Back in 2008, McKinney laid out a platform that almost got no notice from the media in her presidential bid. As in the three prior elections in which the Greens had fielded presidential candidates, McKinney was not permitted to participate in the presidential debates. Nevertheless, the public policy needs that she identified in 2008 remain on the list of issues that polls repeatedly show are important to the country's voters. This is from a TV spot that was produced during McKinney's Green Party presidential bid in 2008.
There are a number of issues that neither John McCain nor Barack Obama want to talk about. I have no problem talking about them. Over 5,000 physicians signed a letter stating that a single-payer healthcare system for our country is the only morally and fiscally responsible way to organize healthcare delivery in our country. Unfortunately, you won't get single-payer from either the Democrats or the Republicans. Nancy Pelosi took impeachment off the table, but the Bush administration is guilty not only of war crimes and torture, but a violation of the Constitution itself. The Democratic Congress should have rolled back the Patriot Act, the Secret Evidence Act, the Military Commissions Act, but they've done nothing to protect our civil liberties. Instead, they've aided and abetted those corporations that helped the Bush administration illegally spy on all of us. I've had the opportunity to visit Detroit several times, and I've seen the manufacturing capacity of that town. Imagine if we put that capacity to work instead of bailing out those predators who are responsible for the crisis, the financial crisis that confronts us all. Imagine if that money had been used to put people to work in the auto industry producing energy efficient cars that no longer are reliant on fossil fuels. The Democratic controlled Congress chose to give $700 billion to people who basically have been predators on the people of this country, on the treasury of this country. And instead of giving them $700 billion, which actually the Congress voted to give them over $800 billion, just imagine what that could have done as in infrastructure investment, greening of our technology, manufacturing green technology in this country, making sure that we invested in a clean, sustainable, energy efficient future for our children and this country. It is clear that the buildup of the prison industrial complex is detrimental to the future of individuals in this country, especially those who have been targeted for special treatment, young, black, and brown people. Sadly, the United States has become the incarceration capital of the world, and some people have figured out a way to make a profit off of that. The prison industrial complex should be dismantled. Racial profiling should no longer exist, should be outlawed in theory, in law, and in practice. The drug war should be eliminated. Intrusions of the federal government into our daily lives should be eliminated. It is intolerable that we have police shooting, and in many cases killing, unarmed young black and brown men. It is intolerable that young black and brown men, and even now families, find themselves sleeping on the streets. Poverty has been criminalized. Youth is being criminalized to the extent that we have more police in our schools than we do school nurses, for example, or those who are charged with making sure that the mental health of our students is intact. This all feeds into the criminal justice system, and unfortunately, some folks have figured out a way to make a profit from that. We should dismantle the prison system as we know it now and completely revamp it so that we have a system of which we can be truly proud and that delivers justice. I can't tell you why the Democratic leadership would not want the Katrina survivors to find a way back home to Louisiana. We've got Katrina survivors who have been strewn by their own government across the country. All the Katrina survivors really want is a way back home. Instead of spending $700 billion for predators on our economy, perhaps one way to have spent that money would have been to clean up the Gulf states, to make sure that people who want to go back home have a way back home. The United States has so much that it can give to the world and that it can give specifically to the continent of Africa. It doesn't have to give Africa AFRICOM, which is just another way of militarizing our foreign policy toward the African continent, stationing troops, pre-positioning military hardware on the continent for the further control of the natural resources and, of course, the human resources that are on that continent.
7 years later, we've yet to see any administration official advocate for single-payer health care, even though a majority of Americans want it and a large majority would benefit from it. President Obama and his Justice Department not only refused to prosecute Bush administration officials for their illegal war on Iraq, the administration continues to fight in that country and in Afghanistan and started new wars in Libya, Syria, and elsewhere, despite the fact that a large majority of the American public still wants peace. The revelations of government spying have continued and expanded in scope under the Obama administration, which has actually prosecuted more whistleblowers than the Bush administration, and which extended the Patriot Act and similar Bush-era laws. Under the Obama administration, Detroit was allowed to file bankruptcy after the White House refused a bailout, leading to foreclosures and massive water shutoffs among the people of that city. A massive bailout to Wall Street under President Obama followed the one granted under President Bush. Mass incarceration, police violence against black and brown communities, and racial profiling still prevail across the land. And despite the cry from the public about all of these issues, they've taken up very little face time at this year's presidential debates. Katrina survivors have still, by and large, not been able to return home, and AFRICOM, born in the last months of the Bush administration, was deployed by President Obama, leaving the armed forces of at least 35 African nations under the practical control of the U.S. military. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.